Inc. comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What could be worse than war? If you measure the severity of conflict according to the number of human lives lost, the truth is that since the beginning of the 20th century, genocide has been markedly more devastating than war, with more than 100 million people killed in episodes of mass slaughter. So what gives rise to this level of bloodthirst, and what power do we have to make it stop? Daniel Jonah Goldhagen is here to talk about it. He spent years teaching political science at Harvard before devoting himself full-time to writing. He published Hitler's Willing Executioners in 1996. His new book is called Worse Than War: Genocide, Eliminationism, and the Ongoing Assault on Humanity. Danny, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
One of the most fascinating things we learn here is that genocide is not, in fact, able to be dismissed as simply a product of the madness of a single individual. There is a predictable pattern to be found in how and when it arises.
Indeed, as you said, it is worse than war. It has produced more deaths during our time than conventional military operations. And we should think about genocide or mass murder as not being a series of horrifying one-off events, such as what is happening in Darfur, what happened before that in Rwanda, what happened before that in Bosnia, but as a systemic feature of the modern world of the international system. And therefore, we should start treating it as such and respond systemically to it. And if we change our thinking about genocide along these lines, the world begins to look different. Our priorities in the international system begin to look different, and the call to do something about this greatest scourge of our time becomes that much louder and more pressing and unavoidable.
One thing you stress here is that genocide itself is simply one tool in a broader syndrome of something you call eliminationism. Can you define that for us?
Right. As horrible as people think genocide is, and they are right to think that, we make a mistake by fixating on genocide, namely the largest of large mass slaughters, and separating it from many other aspects of politics to which it is actually related. And the underlying phenomenon is not the mass killing, not the genocide itself, but a form of modern politics that can be called eliminationism, which is simply put, the decision by states, by political leaders, and those who support them to eliminate groups of people or populaces that they find to be noxious, that they hate, that they find to be an impediment to their political plans. And when they decide to pursue this politics of eliminationism, they then use a variety of means to do it. And the means include massive repression, preventing the group from reproducing itself, incarceration in concentration camps, expulsions, and killing, the largest of which we call genocide. So these various means are but technical solutions for them to the problem of how to eliminate populations. And we should also realize that in every instance of what we call genocide, the perpetrators have used these other means, or at least some of them, in conjunction with mass killing. So let's stop focusing on genocide per se and having debates over what is a genocide, does this qualify, does Darfur qualify, which leads to paralysis, and realize that we need to stop the politics of eliminationism, which has destroyed so many lives, and not just the lives of the people that have been killed, but of all the other people who have been expelled, brutalized, women who have been raped, and so on. The numbers are utterly vast. So this is a fundamental reorientation we need to make, not only about genocide, but about contemporary politics, because this politics of eliminationism is actually part of the toolkit of contemporary political leaders available to them. They know it, and they use it when it is to their advantage as they see it.
What sort of self-delusion do aggressors engage in order to convince themselves that their victims are somehow less than human?
Well, you know, much of what people have believed about other people historically has had little to do with reality or little to do with how we understand the world. It is very common historically and in the contemporary world for people to think that other people lack fundamental human qualities. We call this dehumanization. They seem to be subhumans or even not human beings. Or they hold them to be so in the grip of evil beliefs, whether the evil beliefs reside in their religious beliefs, in political ideologies, or in some other mindset, that they decide that these people, whether less than human in their eyes or demons in their eyes, that they need to be eradicated. This is a very common feature of the world historically and of the contemporary world. And we need to understand in every instance, and it varies how people come to believe these things, how indeed in sometimes entire cultures or the larger part of cultures or subcultures have these beliefs so that people share them. But we should recognize that it is actually a commonplace. It often goes in the name of prejudice or bigotry, which we're all familiar with, and some bigotries, some forms of prejudice, rise to this level where the people are actually demonized or dehumanized, where the conception of them holds them to be far more pernicious than the garden variety prejudices with which we're familiar, where people say, I don't like them because they have this or that quality. This is a profound kind of prejudice. And it is to be found today in many, many parts of the world.
Daniel Jonah Goldhagen is my guest. His new book is called Worse Than War, Genocide, Eliminationism, and the Ongoing Assault on Humanity. Danny, we get a remarkable sense here of the power of language in cultivating public sentiment against the targets of eliminationism. Can you talk about how it's used?
We should realize that much of what we know, in fact, most of what we know about the world beyond our immediate senses, beyond what we encounter in our daily lives, is brought to us, is conveyed to us by language. Take Germany during the Nazi period. Many people are familiar with the Holocaust, where many Germans were anti-Semites, and they willingly participated in the elimination of persecution, indeed in the mass murder of the Jews. Most Germans had never met Jews. In fact, most anti-Semites historically and today have never met Jews, or certainly didn't know Jews well, and certainly didn't know many Jews. What they knew about Jews, and this can be said in our country, what many people know, and know in the sense of what they think about many whites, about African Americans, or many people about gays, or name whatever group there's prejudice against, is what they have heard from others, what they have read, what has been imparted to them through language. Language is the bearer of much of what we know about the world, including the prejudices. And so the critical thing to realize here is that when there is talk, eliminationist talk, in other words, talk that demonizes or dehumanizes groups, or even worse, calls for action, violent eliminationist action against them, that we should take this very, very seriously. It's not just words. It is the seedbed from which the actions grow. And anyone, I venture to say, or maybe virtually everyone who is listening, has heard such talk, that is prejudices from other people in their communities, even probably among their friends, and these things are believed, they're powerful, and they get spread socially through talk, both formal and informal, both in public and private.
So how does this devolve into genocide if it's left unchecked?
Well, it's not as if talk produces systematic mass slaughter or systematic eliminationism. You need two factors to come together for there to be these kinds of assaults. One is for a populace to have the kinds of hatreds or beliefs about people which will lead them to think that somehow that their world, their community, their families, themselves would be better if those people were eliminated somehow. But such hatreds and such prejudices in themselves may, while perhaps producing riots or pogroms or massacres in certain circumstances, will never produce systematic large-scale killing. For that to happen, you need a state and a political leadership to take those views, channel them, organize them, activate them, and coordinate them, that is, the people, in a program of mass killing or elimination. These programs are vast political enterprises that take place over regions and over entire countries and sometimes beyond the borders of a country. Only a state can do that. So you need a political leadership to take the genocidal or eliminationist decision. And when they do, they find that the people whom they represent so often go along willingly, indeed eagerly, with them in the eliminationist assault.
Well, and the fact that these so often take place within sovereign countries, there lies much of the problem, because their leaders understand that essentially they can operate with impunity as long as they don't cross their own borders.
Look, one of the dirty secrets of the international system is that the system is actually set up not to hinder genocide and mass murder, but is actually set up to enable it. Not that everybody wants it to happen, but that is the way the system is set up, because sovereignty, that is state sovereignty, is sacrosanct or near sacrosanct. It is very hard to legally violate the sovereignty of other countries. What that means in our time is that as genocides, mass murders, eliminations have shifted from the 19th century and early part of the 20th century from being often internationally conducted, that is, across borders, it is almost wholly domestically conducted in our more recently and today within the borders of sovereign states, which means that according to international law, according to the UN, according to the way the international system works, countries which would like to stop the eliminationist assault, the murderous assaults upon men, women, and children, would have to actually violate international law and go against the norms of the international community to do so. Now, this makes it hard for states to do it. There are other reasons that we don't intervene or that states haven't intervened, but sovereignty is a huge and in fact devastating problem for all the peoples of the world who do not want to be slaughtered or otherwise eliminated.
Daniel Jonah Goldhagen is my guest. His new book is called Worse Than War, Genocide, Eliminationism, and the Ongoing Assault on Humanity. We will continue our conversation with Danny in just a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also join via email to think@kera.org. There is, of course, Jeff Whittington, a different kind of joining that we are asking people to do today. Join us in supporting KERA, keeping it strong and healthy by making a financial contribution.
800-456-5372. 72 is the telephone number where you can do that. You can also join online at kera.org. And of course, as we usually have when we have an author on during the membership campaign, Chris, we do have copies of Danny's book, Worse Than War, available today. When you join the station at the $120 membership level, we can offer you your very own copy of the book.
You also know that when you listen to the show, you have the chance to interact with our guests. We already have people on the line who want to talk to Danny about his ideas. This is really, we think, a valuable thing about having a locally produced show. We're here for you. We do have people listening all over the world online and through the podcast, but essentially we're here for you in North Texas, and we know that there's an interest in this kind of programming. It's our pleasure to be able to bring it to you, but it's only possible if we have the money it takes to run the station. So if you can make a contribution right now, we would be sincerely grateful. The telephone number is 1-800-456-5372. You can also do this online at kera.org.
And everyone who joins during this hour, and actually the next hour of Think Today, is going to be entered into a special drawing in addition to the drawing for the opera you've been hearing about. If you've been listening all day, there's an overall drawing that for everyone who contributes today. But special during Think, right now, during this hour, your name, if you contribute at kera.org or on the phone at 800-456-5372, you'll be entered into a drawing to win a pair of tickets to the Found Footage Festival tonight at the Lakewood Theater. And actually, one of the founders is going to be on the TV show tomorrow, and we had one of the founders on the radio show last spring when they were here. It's hilarious.
Enormously popular show.
Very popular.
For us, and of course, for these guys who are putting this together, it's they collect little bits of video from all over the country, and these are very unprofessional, and then they put them together and kind of do a Mystery Science Theater 3000 analysis of them.
Yeah, it's like a comedy show with found VHS footage from garage sales, thrift stores, you name it. People are sending them stuff now, too. As a matter of fact, some of the footage was found by comedian David Cross in the current show. So just during Think today, if you contribute right now during this hour, at the end of the hour, we're going to draw two lucky winners, and each of those folks will get two tickets to tonight's show at the Lakewood Theater of the Found Footage Festival. In the next hour, we'll draw two as well. So if you don't win this hour, you can contribute again next hour and have another chance to win tickets to the show tonight.
The telephone number is 1-800-456-5372. You can also go online to make your contribution at kera.org. Want to thank folks like Diane Roberts in Dallas, Zora in Dallas, Greg Gerken in Richardson, and you, if you are on the line right now. Just takes a couple of minutes to call and become a member, and we would ask that you make a contribution at whatever level works for you.
800-456-5372. If you join at the $120 membership level, again, we'll thank you with a copy of Daniel Goldhagen's book, Worse Than War. It's fascinating, and I'm sure if you enjoy these kinds of conversations, you'll enjoy having it. So call us, 800-456-5372, or join online at kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Daniel Jonah Goldhagen. His new book is called Worse Than War, Genocide, Eliminationism, and the Ongoing Assault on Humanity. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. What would change, Danny, if we stopped talking about crimes against humanity and started labeling these events war on humanity?
Well, let me just step back for a moment before answering that to say that I actually think that we have so misunderstood genocide and eliminationism. In fact, we don't talk about eliminationism. That if we actually understand its genesis and its features, then we can do something about it and actually save lives. This is a case where understanding can actually save lives. And so the critical thing to understand is that it's not just that a state is necessary to kill large numbers of people, but that at a specific moment, one man or a small group of men and women sometimes make a decision to unleash an eliminationist or genocidal assault. And they do so because they think that the benefits to them, their politics, will far outweigh the costs. And it is a form of politics. We need to recognize that. And if we do that, we can say, well, let's change the cost-benefit calculus. Let's make it appear to them more costly than beneficial so that they'll make a different decision. There is no genocide that I know of where the political leaders could not have decided otherwise, could not have decided not to kill, and therefore many, many, many more people would not have been killed, would be alive, or would have been alive, or be alive today. So it's important to reconceptualize, among the many other reconceptualizations of genocide, as not being crimes against humanity, as horrible as it may sound, because it's not a crime or a series of crimes that add up to a big crime. It's actually a one-sided war of extermination or elimination that is being conducted by a state with all its resources, against defenseless people, men, women, and children. And if indeed they're conducting a war, then they can be deemed, then two things can happen. One is that we realize we should respond to a war in the manner that we do, in other words, by defending ourselves, defending humanity, and according to the rules of war, not according to the rules of police actions. And the second thing we can say is that those who are conducting a war against humanity should be deemed enemies of humanity. This is an international legal doctrine that has been applied to pirates and therefore are subject to being killed and put the leaders in peril who are actually slaughtering so many innocent men, women, and children. So this shift is not just a linguistic shift, it's not just a semantic change, it's actually an important conceptual shift and what the nature of the problem is and how we ought to respond to it.
So communicate to these people, you will die if you engage in eliminationism.
Excuse me. Right. We do not have an anti-eliminationist system in place. We need a systemic response to the systemic problem, which is the greatest problem of lethal violence in the world today. And if we had an anti-eliminationist system, it would have three components: a prevention system, an intervention system, and a justice system for punishment. Right now, there is no prevention to speak of. There is almost never any intervention that is forceful and effective. And we have an incipient justice system in the form of the International Criminal Court, but it's too slow, too partial, too late, and too ineffective. And so what we need of all of these different components, of all the different components of each of these systems, and I lay them all out in the book, I can't go into them now, we need to focus on prevention. Because quite obviously, we don't want mass eliminations to begin. It's urgent that they don't begin because, as we must remember, the perpetrators can kill 10,000 people in a day. So once they begin, it's already too late. We need to focus on prevention and let the political leaders who are about to take this decision or who are thinking about taking the decision to eliminate and slaughter populations or groups, that they themselves will be subject to being killed, and let them think twice about the wisdom of putting themselves in such jeopardy. In other words, create a deterrent that would be effective and credible, and thereby change the political calculus of all potential future genocidal leaders.
Daniel Jonah Goldhagen is my guest. His new book is called Worse Than War. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Steve in Irving. Hi, Steve.
Hi, I just wondered what the author thinks of the idea. It seems to me that this, when a leader of a state, you know, plays on these prejudicial feelings and takes that action and has support of part of his populace, at least, he's playing on the instinct of self-preservation run amok, distorted by irrational fear, paranoia, and of course misinformation is part of that. But you know, fundamentally, you know, begins with that irrational prejudice against someone who's different, and that fear that they're going to take something from me that I need.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Danny?
Excuse me. Yes, of course, leaders are activating these beliefs that exist in many, many societies. And we do need to understand them. It's important to understand the nature of the beliefs, because actually what people believe about the victims has a lot to do with what they do to them in addition to killing them, and why different eliminations assaults issue in different outcomes. They're not all the same. The numbers of people killed are different. The ways in which the perpetrators treat the victims are different, and we need to understand all of this. But still, the critical matter in working towards prevention is influencing the leaders, because no matter how hard we try from the outside, it is extraordinarily difficult, indeed impossible, to change what large numbers of people in a foreign country believe about groups that they hate. It's very hard to change prejudices even in our own society. We have virtually no ability to do that in other countries. And so we need to focus on the leaders. And we need, because they are cold, calculating, even if they too are sometimes beholden, and often beholden, to irrational views of the world, they are nonetheless cold, calculating leaders of political power and advantage, and that is how we have to address them. We should never forget that as maniacal as they may seem, as filled with hate as they may seem, as irrational as they may seem, all these people have risen to the pinnacle of power in their societies, something which is enormously difficult to do and cannot be done by anyone who is not a prudent and cold-hearted calculator of power and advantage. So that's what we need to think about, and that is what we know how to fashion policy to affect.
We have an email here from Carrie in Richardson, who writes, I have tried to get people to care about Darfur and Sudan, and I haven't been successful. What does the world need to care about our fellow human being, no matter where they are, their gender, religion, or the color of their skin?
Well, we have to humanize the victims, and it sounds as if something we don't need to do, because people realize that they're human beings who are being killed, and we all, I would say, feel empathy for them. But we lose their individuality in the numbers. 10,000 people, it's overwhelming. 100,000 people, almost 3 million people. The Sudanese have eliminated almost 3 million people in Darfur. It's overwhelming. We need to think about them as we do about what would happen in our neighborhoods. Imagine if someone were bludgeoned or hacked to death in your streets, in the streets of your neighborhood or in front of your house. What would you do? You'd be up in arms, and your whole community would be, and the media would be, and there would be governmental action. If it happened to only one person in our streets, what happens again and again around the world to so many people? And we need to think of all those people as being no different from the people in our neighborhoods, in our streets, and that we have a responsibility to them. The question, I tell this to journalists all the time, I'll tell this to you, Chris, if you have an opportunity. If you get to interview President Obama or Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, ask them the following question. How many African lives equal in value the life of one American? Is it 10, 100, 1,000? What's their conception? A million? At what point do we say enough people are being killed that it is worth risking the life of one American? Or you could ask the Chancellor of Germany or the Prime Minister of Great Britain or any other country the same question. At what point does the calculus become that we must act? Let them give a number and defend the number. My view is that the lives of Africans are every bit as valuable as the lives of Americans, and I have no reason to feel that I should be roused or to action more. I live in Massachusetts. If someone in California or Texas is being killed, than if someone in Sudan or Rwanda or Bosnia is being killed. Their lives are equally valuable. And so we have to drum into people's heads two things, that we must have empathy for these people, and the other thing is that it would be easy to stop if we did something. Because most people would like there not to be mass slaughter and elimination in the world, but they think the problem is overwhelming and intractable, that there's nothing we can do about it. If they would learn that if our political leaders would start getting serious about creating an anti-eliminationist system with a deterrence to the political leaders to make these decisions, they could actually change their lives. In fact, we can say that our political leaders are implicated in these mass murders if they don't take the easy steps they can take to stop them or prevent them and save so many people's lives. So this is what we need to communicate to people. It can be done.
The first step you see is to remove eliminationist regimes from participating in any kind of international institutions. Does that take the ability to do diplomacy away?
You can still have diplomacy if countries are not international institutions. The reason to remove them from international institutions is to create enormous pressure on them to change their ways, indeed to change their form of governance. One of the things that many people have talked about democratization over the last decade or so, and done so in a variety of ways. And one of the lessons we haven't learned from recent history is how effective we can be when trying in peaceful ways to democratize other countries. There have been two instances in the last few decades in which there has been a concerted attempt to democratize the countries of different regions of the world by saying to them, making it clear that if you want to be part of the club, you must be democratic. The first was in Latin America, when the U.S. under Jimmy Carter, and thereafter, it didn't evolve, there was some evolution, made it clear that military dictatorships are no longer going to be allowed. That if they want to play ball with us, if they want us to play ball with them, they have to be democratic. And lo and behold, a region that was to a great extent non-democratic, run by military dictatorships, became in a few years a region that was governed almost overwhelmingly by democratic regimes. The second instance is in Europe. With the fall of the Soviet Union, the Western European countries, the European Union, made it clear that if the Central and Eastern European former communist countries wanted to be members of the EU and gain benefits from the EU, that they would have to be democratic. And suddenly, these countries, many of which had had no practice in democracy for decades upon decades, indeed really never, suddenly, overnight, became democratic, and they're problematic countries, they have their problems, but have remained so. We have enormous power with our economic might and with our diplomatic might to affect these kinds of changes, and yet I have yet to see the leaders of our world articulate what we know to work and say we should follow this policy elsewhere.
Daniel Jonah Goldhagen is my guest. His new book is called Worse Than War, Genocide, Eliminationism, and the Ongoing Assault on Humanity. We'll resume our conversation in just a moment. If you would like to receive a copy of the book Worse Than War, we have it available as a thank you gift this afternoon with a $120 contribution or above. You can make that at 1-800-456-5372 or online at kera.org. Jeff Whittington joins me once again, senior producer of Think. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. We'd love to hear from you right now at 800-456-5372 or via the web at kera.org. Chris, we've raised $206,000 thanks to the generosity of our listeners who are also contributors to the station. So thank you so much if you've done your part. If you've not, please take this opportunity right now to call 800-456-5372 or pledge online at kera.org. We're trying to reach the $240,000 mark today and $300,000 mark by the end of the day tomorrow, because we'd really like to end this thing before November. I mean, the way we do the drive is we have a goal to start with, and once we reach the goal, the drive's over. And so our goal, our dollar goal and our time goal all hopefully will coincide sometime next week. Of course, the sooner you call, the sooner you pledge online, the faster the drive will end.
1-800-456-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email, not send email, you can get online. Sorry, I'm getting that old habit. You can get online at kera.org and make a contribution there. For the 2 hours of the Think program today, we have a special offer for people who are joining. You have a possibility of winning a pair of tickets to the Found Footage Festival, which will take place tonight at the Lakewood Theater. This is special to Think listeners and contributors because you guys are the ones who really have told us that you really love this show.
Yeah, these guys, one of these guys was on, Joe Pickett was on last spring when they came through on the radio. We're actually having Nick Prewer, the other co-creator, on the TV show tomorrow. So you can check him out tomorrow night at 7:30 on Channel 13 on the Think television show. But they've offered us some tickets. They've offered us four pairs of tickets. So we're going to give away two pairs this hour and two pairs next hour. So if you call 800-456-5372, if you pledge online, if you contribute online at kera.org, you're automatically entered to win these tickets. And we're going to draw two people at the end of this hour, two people at the end of the 1 o'clock hour, and your names will be plus one at will call for tonight's show at the Lakewood Theater. I went last year. It's hilarious. It's really hilarious. It's not for kids. I will tell you, it's not for little kids, but it's really funny stuff.
You know, it's interesting. Jeff and I were talking about this. In some ways, it's kind of an odd combination with the topic that we're talking about right now, because, of course, our guest this hour is Daniel Jonah Goldhagen, and his book is about genocide and eliminationism. It is, in many ways, though, the beauty of this show that you, our audience, will go with us to things that are light and funny and sort of
Sure. Examine
the world in that way. And also, so many of you care deeply and passionately to know a great deal of information about the underside of the world and the mm-hmm. things that aren't working and the things that we need to be fixing. And we have found that for you as an audience, it's not a stretch to go from one topic to the next. We know that you appreciate why we're doing it this way today, because the event is taking place tonight. We would invite you to participate in the creation of this show by helping to pay for it. It's very simple. We come to you very directly and say, we can't do this for free. I venture to say most of the staff here probably would if we could, but it's not possible. If you can make a contribution and help out, we will be grateful. The number is 1-800-456-5372.
We've heard from many of you at many different levels. We've had a $75 contribution. We've had a $60 contribution. We've had $180, $120. We've had a $1,500 contribution this hour.
Thanks for that.
So thanks to everyone who's called. Ginger Spencer in Dallas. Also, Tara Legary in Irving. We've also heard from Robert Kirkpatrick in McKinney and Joyce Colley in Dallas. We'd like to hear from you. 800-456-5372. Do it online at kera.org. Please do it right now. And thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Daniel Jonah Goldhagen. His new book is called Worse Than War: Genocide, Eliminationism, and the Ongoing Assault on Humanity. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. I want to talk for a minute about the people who are carrying out these atrocities on the sort of foot soldier level. First of all, there are theories that these people engage in this simply as a matter of peer pressure, and your response to that is what?
The evidence is overwhelming that this is not the case. Mm-hmm. One of the central features of all elimination assaults is the cruelty that the perpetrators inflict upon the victims, cruelty beyond and above the act of killing, which itself can be conceived of as cruel. They routinely torture, beat, brutalize, mock, degrade the victims. And the question is why? If they're just being pressured to do what they don't want to do, or if they're somehow deemed to be blindly obedient to authority, this is another view that is commonly said, they would not so frequently torture the victims. The only way to understand why they do it is because they're expressing their true beliefs about the rightness of the deed and about what the victims in their view deserves. And it's not just their actions that are so telling, but also their words, which are reported to us by victims and by the perpetrators themselves. In both the book and the film, I should say, we've done a film for PBS, which will be on PBS nationally on April 7th this coming year. We We've done a documentary in which we have perpetrators on camera telling us of why they do what they do. And they genuinely believed, as one perpetrator, a Rwandan, told us, that the Tutsi are not human beings. And he further explained that this led to a cloud that came over their hearts towards the Tutsi, and an anger and a rage, and that is how they perpetrated the genocide. And this is enormously common. We have vast amounts of testimony, not just from Rwanda, not just from the Holocaust, but from Guatemala, and place after place after place where the perpetrators have so brutalized their victims. We have to remember that they're often slaughtering children, and doing so in the most brutal and gruesome ways, which I won't recount here. You have to ask yourself, what can lead someone to treat a child with such ferocity unless he believes that the child is somehow not human or demonic, that is part of a demonic clan, and needs to be eradicated? So the evidence is clear. The perpetrators are, by and large, there are exceptions, but by and large, willing executioners, and they're willing because they're beholden to prejudices or conceptions of the world which tell them that it is right and necessary, indeed urgent, to slaughter the people or otherwise eliminate them, the people they are assaulting.
So with that overwhelming level of eliminationist sentiment in a country where this is taking place, assuming that it was possible to remove every perpetrator of violence, you still don't immediately wipe away the residual sentiment. What do you do to heal a country after the killing has stopped?
This is one of the most vexing aspects of genocide or eliminationist assaults, because when you have a state with a large percentage of the people of a group or of a country conducting eliminationist assault on another group or people, the problem is just overwhelming. What do you do? How do you mete out justice, assuming you're in a position to do so? Take in Rwanda. The Rwandan justice system, which had, I forget the number, but a tiny handful of lawyers in the country, the number is something like 10, 20 perhaps, in the entire country after the genocide, that is, who were not among the perpetrators, they have processed 1.2 million people who are suspected of taking part in the genocide, convicting 900,000 or so and acquitting about 300,000. This is overwhelming. What do you do? How can you even go about doing this, and how do you then heal in other ways? And different societies and different groups have taken different approaches. In South Africa, they've had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. In Rwanda, they have sought to mete out justice using a variety of forms of justice, many of which have been criticized by Western human rights groups because they don't follow Western notions of due process. Other societies, and this is what by and large happens, is they just bury the hatchet and say, okay, it's time to move on, and the victims just have to suffer more. Yet another reason, as if we need one, to prevent genocidal or eliminationist assaults from taking place, is it is impossible to pick up the pieces. It really is. The pain, the hurt, the suffering, even among those who stay alive, goes on for the rest of their lives. I have sat across from so many victims and heard them tell me their stories from all over the world. Horrifying, deeply moving, gut-wrenching stories. You sit there, or I sit there thinking, I can't imagine suffering for 5 minutes what this person has suffered for years at a time sometimes, and indeed for the rest of their lives, because they carry the scars with them and the losses with them. This is what we have to prevent.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Brant in Dallas. Hello, Brant.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, how do the guidelines, Dan's guidelines for dealing with the potential for genocide, avoid or help prevent political meddling or meddling into state or the politics of a particular state?
What we should do is set up an international watchdog agency. The democratic countries of the world should set it up. And in fact, if only one or two countries want to set it up, it's fine with me, because the imperative is to get something done here, which will have clear criteria by which they can adjudicate whether an elimination assault seems imminent and, indeed, whether one has begun. And today, with all our technology, we know We know for sure when these things are happening. This is not 1900 when the Belgians could slaughter millions in the Congo and nobody really knew about it. People start streaming from their homes and regions and into other countries. We have satellite photos of villages being burnt, of depredations of all kinds. We have reports from victims. We know almost immediately. And this international body should use clear criteria of eliminationism to declare when such an assault is seemingly imminent or when it takes place and trigger all of the interventionist measures, or indeed trigger those preventive measures that we have promised we would undertake, and which, if they fail to stop the perpetrators, we then implement in order to get them to stop as quickly as possible their eliminationist assaults. One should realize that we don't have to worry about countries meddling too much in other countries' affairs because there are powerful reasons for them not to do it, and they don't do it right now. It's very hard to get countries to intervene in other countries' affairs. And so we should actually mobilize those countries that are willing to act, and you know, we can deal with some of the fallout of that if there is, when it happens. But right now, we must realize that any policy that I'm recommending or any reasonable policy that we might pursue to save lives is should not be considered, even if it is unconventional, to be radical. What is radical is the status quo. The status quo is basically us watching as people slaughter men, women, and children by the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and millions. That is radical. Let's get something done, not worry too much about whether we can implement the policy perfectly and so on and so forth, because we have to change the status quo, the radical, horrifying status quo, which is both immoral and actually to the disadvantage not just of the people being slaughtered, but to the rest of the world as well.
Why is it so critical that not only do we take action about what's happening right now, but that we make sure that we go back and get the history right on incidents that have already concluded?
One thing that you hear from victims again and again is they want the truth to be told. They want the world to know what they have suffered, and they know that if you can mobilize empathy on the part of other people, you have a greater chance to prevent future killings. You're asking a general question. Why should we ever care about the past, getting it right? And, you know, you can either think it's important or not. And it's no less important, certainly, regarding genocidal or eliminationist assaults than it is understanding why the civil rights movement happened, for example, or, you know, name anything you want. So, but it's particularly important, as I show in my book, to study eliminationist assaults, first to reconceptualize genocide as a form of eliminationist politics, then to study and understand them, because as I have suggested, if you understand from them why and how and the exact mechanisms by which they occur and the critical role of political leadership, then you can fashion different policies and effective policies. If we don't know why they've happened and what the mechanisms have been, we literally won't know what to do about it. And it is shocking to me that despite all that has been said and written about genocide, that this very obvious and specific and discrete mechanism of political leaders making decisions has not been put forward as the critical moment and the one, the decision-making moment, that we can change, know how to change, and can actually very easily do so. My contention is that if our president and the leaders of the major European countries, or let's say NATO as an institution, actually made it a priority of theirs to stop mass killing and elimination around the world, that it could be done almost overnight, extremely effectively, and we would put an end to or certainly reduce the incidence of mass slaughter in the 21st century so it would look nothing like the 20th century. That is how easy I think it would be if they would do it.
Daniel Jonah Goldhagen's new book is called Worse Than War, Genocide, Eliminationism, and the Ongoing Assault on Humanity. Danny, it's been a really fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. I want to thank all of you who are listening right now, all of you who have called to make a contribution to KERA to allow us to bring you substantive interviews with guests who are internationally known for their work. Daniel Jonah Goldhagen is just one example. If you would like to receive a copy of his new book, Worse Than War, we have that available as a thank you gift at the $120 level. You just pick up the phone and call 1-800-456-5372. You can also go online to KERA. KERA.org and receive it there. Your contribution level is up to you. You know, you may not want a thank you gift, or you may want to get the book tomorrow, so you go to the bookstore and buy it instead. Then just make a similar contribution to KERA and get the book on your own. That is up to you. The amount that you donate is up to you. You know, some of you have no problem writing a check or putting $1,500 on your credit card. For some of you, $5 or $10 or $20 a month is really a sacrifice, and we appreciate it. We ask that whatever amount you decide to give, that you do in fact use your dollars to make a vote in support of public radio, and also to take action in support of public radio. Jeff Whittington is here with us now, senior producer of Think, and I see you waving a piece of paper, which tells me something exciting is here.
Well, we just got word. This just in, Chris. we just got word that we have some tickets to see Garrick Ohlsson in concert at Bass Hall. This is a limited credit card only offer on Tuesday, October 27th, 7:30, Orchestra 2 seating at Bass Hall. These are available at the $50 membership level, which is pretty reasonable.
Wow.
If you use your credit card. So don't forget, everyone who calls 800-456-5372 or joins online at kera.org also gets, oh, I'm okay, I'm being corrected. $50 is one ticket. The pair of tickets is $100. But you could win a pair of tickets to tonight's Found Footage Festival at the Lakewood in the next hour. Are these the winners for this hour?
Carla Ramberger in Grand Prairie, congratulations, and Ginger in Dallas. Congratulations, and especially thanks to both of you for your contributions.
Yes, thank you so much. Now, that said, we're going to draw two more winners at the end of the next hour. So call 800-456-5372. And what could you win? You could win a pair of tickets to tonight's Found Footage Festival at the Lakewood Theater at 8 o'clock. These guys are hilarious. They get all this... Angela Lansbury exercise video is one example of the kind of thing that you might get to laugh at a little bit.
That's the one from last time that I still can't get out of my head, much as I've tried.
Car dealer,
she's in a bubble
commercials.
Bath.
She is. I think they have all new stuff, though. Apparently, they're coming up. They have tons and tons of stuff, and they can't put it out fast enough.
They found old video dating samples from, looks like, the era of the mullet, maybe early 90s, and
nice.
It's not to be missed.
Pretty nice stuff. So you could win tickets to that if you call 800-456-5372 or pledge online at kera.org.
I want to say thanks to all of you who have been calling this hour, especially Robin Gill Lacey in Dallas.
Thank you, Robin.
And Skylar Wick in Louisville. And Rollins Gilliland, our good friend in Dallas. Dwayne Elliott in Grand Prairie. I'm surprised Rollins isn't here to make his contribution.
I know.
And
I'm wondering if Rollins is going to pledge during my show tomorrow now.
Oh, now you've put the pressure
on. You know,
on.
I mean, what's up? we also heard from Dr. Ann Jorgulis in Coppell and Chuck Cuttigan in Allen. Thanks so much to each of you. We really appreciate the fact that you are supporting a station. You know what? A station that we support too. Chris and I both listen to the station. I listen kind of compulsively. are we on the air? Are we still on the air? And we consume the product as well. So we're not asking you to do anything that we haven't already done. We support the station as well. So we're asking you to join us as listeners and supporters. We just happen to work here. And that's why we're here asking you to do your part at 800-456-5372.
You can also do this online at kera.org. You know, it happens at least once or twice a week that Jeff and I come in and we're having our sort of morning conversation about what's going on in the week. And we'll say, we'll drop a fact that both of us have heard that day in Morning Edition. Both of us feeling very smart and well-informed. And then
that's
we'll have
right.
to go, yeah, I heard it too.
Yeah, well, you know, and quite frankly, you know, I'll hear something that's scheduled for our show on Weekend Edition and say, wow, you know, that's going to be really good, and we're going to spend more than 8 minutes with the author or with the filmmaker or with the whoever it is that they're talking to, and we're going to give you the chance to call in and talk to them. So if that's worth something to you, and I think it probably is because you listen, we hear from you all the time. Someone was calling during the last show, finding out how to get a copy of the show with Goldhagen. They already wanted a copy of the show.
Very nice.
While the show is still going on. So, you know, we know that this show and this kind of programming is important to you. The station wouldn't be here if it wasn't, because, you know, this kind of thing, when you make a product, give it away for free, and then ask people to pay for it, If people don't pay for it, it's not going to be there. So it's here, and you should support it because you use it. 800-456-5372.
This is your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1 Dallas-Fort Worth Denton, K261 CW 100.1 in Tyler, K202 DR 88.3 in Wichita Falls, and K257 EV 99.3 in Sherman.
And no matter where you listen, of course, you're listening to KERA. It's your public radio service right here in North Texas, based right here at 3000 Harry Hines Boulevard, serving the DFW Metroplex and beyond. And we really appreciate your support when you call 800-456-KERA or join online at kera.org.
Remember, once again, that if you are interested in reading Daniel Jonah Goldhagen's new book, Worse Than War, Genocide, Eliminationism, and the Ongoing Assault on Humanity, we do have that available this afternoon as a thank you gift. You just need to make a contribution of $120 or above. You can do that online at kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-456-5372. We'll be back in just a minute.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.